So we're here today to remember and glorify Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And he has a historical context. And I just thought I'd share with you two coins that were minted in the year of his birth in India. I just happened to have them. Two coins from 1874. And it's interesting because this was, it says India, one quarter Anna. Anna is actually, the Bengalis made it Anna. It was actually Panna. So when you see in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's Panna. So it cost two pannas to buy the food to serve Lord Chaitanya. When Lord Chaitanya came to visit your house, it would cost two pannas to have enough food to feed him and his entourage. And that came into Anna, and that's the... Why, thank you, sir. Hare Krishna. So here you go. Just pass it around. It's all right. Unusual little activity to go on in. And as that's passing around, it's another very, very tiny little thing. This is a little part of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's shoe. Just happened to have that as well. So just touch it to your head and pass it on. Don't open this up because it's difficult to open. So when it opens, it goes flip. And when it goes flip, the little bit goes whoosh, and we never see it again. Nope, ladies first. Very intelligent, well done you. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is such an interesting person from many points of view. He is a tremendous innovator. You know, what he did for our tradition is quite astonishing. He always gave the credit, as did Srila Prabhupada, to Bhaktivinoda Thakur for being the pioneer of what who we are now. It was the case that Gaudiya Vaishnavism had descended into disrepute in Bengal and Orissa and Bihar and Assam, where it was strongest. Mainly through the activities of the Appa Sampradayas. Sampradayas who interpreted Chaitanya's teachings as meaning that I am Radha, you are Krishna, let's get it on, and all that kind of stuff. And so it wasn't held in very good repute. And you see from writers of the time that they weren't taking it seriously, even though it was popular. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the first of our acharyas really to engage with Western culture, with Christianity, and with Enlightenment thought, the kind of philosophy of the Enlightenment that rules the roost these days. And he also, in engaging with that, as with most Bengalis of the time, the history was that the center of British power was in Calcutta. So Bengali intellectuals were the one who were front and center engaging with the West. And that period, those persons were called the Bhadra Lok. They were the collection of people. And they're very famous people. The Dayananda Saraswati, the Brahma Samaj, the Arya Samaj grew out of that, all as responses. Vivekananda grew out of that as a response. Aurobindo grew out of that as a response. So Krishna, Krishna. A lot of what we consider to be Hinduism or even Vaishnavism in some of its forms today grew out as responses to this. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur was one of these responders, one of the more orthodox responders. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur created an institution which in Gaudiya Vaishnavism to that period was unknown. There was no institution that promoted a mission or even was a collective of any particular kind. societies and clubs and institutions were a thing of the 19th century. So Bhaktivinod Thakur started one. Bhaktisiddhanta developed it. So a lot of what he did was developing on what Bhaktivinod Thakur had started. But in one sense, in starting it, in writing an awful lot, in propagating his literature, and it wasn't just around Bengal, Bhaktivinod Thakur propagated his literature all over the world. So in Oxford University, we have, in the Bodleian Library, we have a book that was posted to them by Bhaktivinod Thakur, with his inscription, his photograph, his signature, a letter of, you know, gifting the book to the library. And he did this to universities all over the world and institutions. So it's a very forward-thinking process. Bhaktisiddhanta took that forward an awful lot, because Bhaktivinod Thakur only worked really in Bengal apart from that effort. But he was the one who said, in the future, on the plains of Mayapur, Americans, French, and Russians, and English will chant Nitai Gora Haribol, Nitai Gora Haribol. And at the time, of course, India was part of the Raj. It was kind of a nonsensical statement to make. If India is part of the Raj, Russia's trying to get into India, so there's a whole conflict going on there. America is insignificant at the time. And the French? What has it got the French got to do with it? Yet this was his vision, a vision that has been fulfilled, but at the time didn't make any sense at all. So he had a very clear vision, but he didn't expand very much on it in physical terms. A little society in Bengal. But Bhaktisiddhanta took that and brought it all over India. Not only all over India, but understanding Bhaktivinod Thakur's desire, he started to explore other countries. England, of course, was famously one of them. Also Germany. Bon Maharaj lived in Germany for quite some time until he got kicked out. When the Nazis realized that we weren't into Aryan philosophy, the concept of you're not the body meant that you're not German. So that was kind of went against the Nazi grain. And it was very fortunate, because Bon Maharaj was just about to meet Himmler and Goebbels. That would have been a disaster for our tradition. So Krishna was kind. But they started a society here in the UK. And so it was a little foothold. But this was very much Bhaktisiddhanta's vision. It's very interesting that our acharyas like Bhaktivinod, Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Prabhupada, if we look at their example, they all give credit to the one before, but they've all done tremendously more, in effect. So Bhaktisiddhanta did so much more than Bhaktivinod Thakur. He took the Gaudiya Mat all over India, literally everywhere. There was Gaudiya Mats popping up. He was preaching in Bombay. He was preaching in Madras. He was preaching in Tirupati, in Srirangam, in Kambakoram. He was preaching up in the north. So he traveled all over the place. They had a Gaudiya Mat in Gaya. You know, they really established everywhere. This was the vision was clear. This is tremendously more than Bhaktivinoda Thakur did. But he gave all credit to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, because he was the one who envisaged this and started the process. And the particular contribution of Bhaktivinoda Thakur was, He made Gaudiya Vaishnavism intellectually appealing. He made it appealing to the intelligent class of people. And this target audience of the intelligent class of people has been a kind of a theme running through our missionary process. You can see it in Srila Prabhupada's books. So his books aren't just ordinary books. These are scholarly books. So we give out a book on the street, you're thinking a popular book. But this is a book with Devanagari script, Romans transliteration, word for word, and then translation, and then a commentary. That's a scholarly book. That's a book designed for the intellectual class of men. These are the terms that our acharyas used. This was their target audience. Bhaktivinod Thakur totally focused on this audience in Bengal to redeem Gaudiya Vaishnavism, to rise it up so people could see what is this about? Well, it's not all about all that nonsense. This is what it's about. So he goes into the text. He reads the Bengali. He reads the Sanskrit. He has to learn the languages so that he can translate it, so that he can speak in a learned way about it and present. This is actually what the principles are. These are the principles. This is how we approach this subject. So Bhaktisiddhanta, working on that basis, without that basis, there isn't a basis. If it's just practice, the unfortunate thing is practice simply led, unfortunately, to sahajism. If there isn't a knowledge base, it just becomes sentiment. You're just doing the practices and you just, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, but you don't know why necessarily. So you just start to speculate. How do you feel? I feel good. This is really feel good. This is about feeling good. And it is feeling good, yes, but it's married with something else. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur showed that. Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. Vairagya Vidya and Bhakti Yoga, they run on parallel tracks. You can't take the knowledge base out. There is an intellectual tradition. It's very rich in our culture. You go back to the Goswamis. The six Goswamis, they wrote such profound literature. Incredible. Absolutely incredible literature. It dominated the period. That period. It dominated the whole thought process of bhakti. The development of bhakti in that medieval period. Krishnadas Kaviraj's biography, Chaitanya Charitamrita, is a magnificent piece of literature. What to speak of theology and philosophy. It's a work of genius in terms of literature. These are very intelligent, learned people. The Goswamis spoke many languages. They spoke Persian. You know, they really had the breadth that it took to understand the bigger picture so that they could present it. So how did Rupa Goswami present it? He presented rasa theory. Now, for us, we think the word rasa and we take it, oh, this is a given. It's not a given. Rasa theory is a process of literary criticism in Indian culture. It had nothing to do with religion or spirituality. It was from Bharat and various people going back centuries. So he was fully aware of the scriptures dealing with drama and literary process. And he used those theories to develop theology. This is very intellectual. It's a very intelligent, learned person. Why, thank you kindly. I even get it back. I'm impressed. Impressed. So this is the legacy that these people are taking forward. So Bhaktisiddhanta is so interesting, his education. He was highly educated. He went to Sanskrit College in Calcutta for further education. He didn't like education, because he didn't like the educational process, but he became educated. He went through all the courses and he never did homework. Once he left the classroom, he just left it behind and, you know, not interested. Read other things. He just imbibed it so quickly. He was so smart. So he didn't ignore his education. He didn't respect how education was delivered or the system of education. He thought it was a nonsense. But he realized this necessity. And he was so highly educated that this guy, Yeats Brown, I don't know if you ever hear of Yeats Brown, he was a well-known author in the last century. And he traveled India quite a lot. And he was in the Bengal Lancers. Lancer at Large is the name of this book. It's quite a well-known book, published in 1936. And one of the chapters in it is The Lotus Feet of Lord Krishna. And in the footnote, he recites the full Maha Mantra. So he describes a visit to the Gaudiya Math in Calcutta. And he says, the cult of Krishna is a pure and exalted doctrine. But I must confess that as explained by the publications of the Gaudiya Math, it is extremely complex. The most difficult that my poor brain has ever attempted to grasp. The language was so highly intellectual that even this English literary gentleman was having difficulty. For instance, the president of the Math, who is Bhaktisiddhanta, said in a lecture to his disciples, quote, The undesirable imperfection observed in the temporal relativity of nature should not be carried to an unknown region where there is not much anthropomorphic, ephemeral, defective welcoming. The weight of such measuring temperament would prove too heavy to be carried by the feeble porter with mundane relative reasons. Moreover, there is no warranty of exact dovetailing in the transcendental vacuum. Obvious, isn't it? And he goes on, he quotes more, he says, a meaning there is, he says. I think it can be put roughly thus, that the ordinary brain cannot distinguish between the various planes of existence and that special methods are required to develop the special senses of the mystic. I give the extracts above not in rebellious spirit, so he's not trying to be offensive. Their writer is an athlete of the undifferentiated absolute who is preaching the old lesson that there is more things in heaven and earth that are dreamed of in our mundane philosophies. Indeed, I find his expositions stimulating. And he goes on to praise Bhaktisiddhanta. But so it's just interesting that, you know, you're reading a piece of literature and all of a sudden, here's Bhaktisiddhanta. And someone trying to understand him. Why? Because he's an intellectual. He's speaking to us from a very high place. So what's the mission about? And his exposition of the mission is so much more than Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur was fully enthused about the fact that all this would happen. Bhaktisiddhanta was fully enthused, but knowing that I can only fulfill this little bit. Prabhupada, fully enthused, took it all over the world, but knowing that I can only fulfill this little bit. So what's the little bit we have to fulfill in our little lives? To understand who these people are, what they're trying to do, what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was trying to do. And his innovations, as I say, are quite profound. The things that we can do that sadhus and brahmins and people couldn't do before. Now, I just want to share with you, just to change the subject just a little bit. These are just things that I refer to every now and then in my life. They're just quotes from Bhaktisiddhanta. I won't get into, you know, chapter and verse where they're from. It's just a cumulative quotes I've just accumulated over the years. And every now and then I just take them out and read them, just for enthusing myself. One is, every spot on earth where discourses of God are held is a place of pilgrimage. Every spot on earth where discourses of God are held is a place of pilgrimage. I'm just wondering if that includes churches and mosques and synagogues. That seems to be what he's saying, actually. So that's actually very encouraging. That means there's a lot of talk going on. There's a lot going on the planet. We have to encourage it. We have to be part of it. We have to encourage it here, but we have to encourage it elsewhere as well. So maybe we can't go around to all the temples, churches, and mosques and convert them into becoming Hare Krishnas. Why would they? They've already got their thing going on. But if they're going to have discourses of God, maybe we can enthuse them in their discourses about God, give them something more to think about without having to invite them to change their religion. It's not maybe not relevant, maybe not important in terms of the bigger picture. Another is possession of objects not related to Krishna is our main malady. Possession of objects not related to Krishna is our main malady, our main illness. And that's an interesting perspective. So, for instance, I've always had a compulsion of sorts to collect things. I just can't stop doing it. You know, I just start collecting things. So, for instance, you have these coins. So I just happened to have two coins the year of Bhaktisiddhanta's birth. Just happened to have them, you know. But I like collecting coins. Maybe it's like I was a magpie in my last life. I like shiny things or something. So I dovetail my collection, and I find coins from the date of Bhaktisiddhanta's birth, Prabhupada's birth. I find coins of Hussein Shah. Does anyone know who Hussein Shah is? So Hussein Shah, Rupa Goswami was his private secretary, and Sanatana Goswami was his prime minister. So I have 3 silver coins of Hussein Shah. These are coins that the Goswamis could have actually touched. So they remind me of Krishna. There's so many ways we can engage in the possession of objects, because not having the possession, what do we do then? Have nothing? You come into our house, no furniture. Why? Well, this is not related to Krishna. But we have to understand what is related to Krishna. I think in one sense, for a devotee, what's not related to Krishna, if we're leading our life in the right way. So all of a sudden, I can collect coins with a heart and a half. And I can make a nice coin collection. I have coins from Nasrut Shah, Hussein Shah's son, the time of Nityananda Prabhu's preaching in Bengal, Haridas Thakur's preaching, of Suraj Mal. Suraj Mal was the person who built Kusum Sarovar in Govardhan. So, and then you get all these things, and you remember this place, and you remember this person, you remember these pastimes. Even Hussein Shah isn't a Vaishnav, but he's reminding me of Krishna. So what does this mean? Another one is, let me not desire anything but the highest good for my worst enemies. There's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? So your worst enemies, it's not even you're just people you half don't like, you know, some politician that annoys you. Your worst enemies. I suppose the idea of having an enemy is a bit of a rasabas for a devotee anyway, but it seems that we have them, so. Let me not desire anything but the highest good. There is a story of Bhaktisiddhanta, when he went to Bag Bazar temple, every time he went to the temple, so they opened this beautiful temple in Calcutta, really wonderful, and made with marble and everything. It was really the... Oh, thank you very much. Really the highest class. And everyone's really proud of it. But the little salt in the sweet rice was every time Bhaktisiddhanta came to give a lecture, this gentleman would come and at the back, and he would criticize at the end of the lecture. He would just criticize him, heckle, and ask stupid questions and point out flaws. And the devotees were really annoyed with this guy. He'd turn up every time, and only when Bhaktisiddhanta came. So what is going on? So one time he didn't turn up. Bhaktisiddhanta appeared, and at the end it was nothing, just some respectful questions. And Bhaktisiddhanta asked, he said, what happened to this gentleman who used to come? And the devotee said, oh, Krishna's very kind, he died. And Bhaktisiddhanta started to cry. Because he said, every time he came, he kept me humble. He reminded me who I was. He was sent by Krishna for me. So he only desired, he didn't desire him to die. The devotees were thinking, you know, problem. This guy's a problem. This guy's a, you know. You know, you're organizing your guru's tour, and every time you organize everything, thank you so much, you organize everything so perfectly, down to the thing, and the prasadam is great, and even the weather is great, and there's this idiot at the back heckling every time. You know, you nearly want to go to South India and hire some Brahmin to do a yogya so his tongue falls out. But that's not the mood of the Vaishnavas. So it's very interesting how he turned this into a spiritual thing. He just accepted what was. And everything that came was coming from Krishna. And this leads on to the next saying. A devotee feels the presence of God everywhere, but one averse to the Lord denies his existence anywhere. And this is very, very true. And in one sense, a lot of us are kind of in the middle here. We're kind of accepting the presence of the Lord everywhere, and then on Tuesdays, we deny the presence of God anywhere, according to our mental instability. So something good happens, Krishna, Krishna. Something bad happens, oh, I have such bad karma, I'm a bad person, no one loves me, and all that kind of stuff. That's denying the presence of God. It's denying that this bad thing, this heckler, or some other thing that happens in your life, death of a loved one, or an accident, or you break your leg, but it's never going to heal properly, some calamity, is not Krishna. Why do we decide it's not Krishna? That Krishna is not kind. That Krishna's mercy is what we decide it is, not what he gives us. So how do we see Krishna everywhere? The presence of God. How do we practice the presence of God in every part of our lives? Even in the most inconvenient parts. And a lot of the inconvenient parts are to do with people. People are awfully inconvenient. Impersonalism is actually a very attractive philosophy. It makes a lot of sense as soon as you meet people. Because people are just difficult to deal with. And I think leading on from that is another. He says, when faults in others misguide you and delude you, have patience, introspect, find faults in yourself. Know that others cannot harm you unless you harm yourself. When faults in others misguide you and delude you, have patience, introspect, find faults in yourself. Know that others cannot harm you unless you harm yourself. So the faults of others misguide and delude us. The classic example of this is, I don't know any devotees here who have started a temple or started a community of some kind, and there comes a tipping point. Everyone gets involved and it's all very jolly and Krishna Krishna and Hari Hari, and then someone in the community decides not to serve one day. So everyone's serving wholeheartedly, and someone decides not to turn up for their service or not to just sit at the back or say, I have rounds to chant, and not muck in and clean the floor and do the needful. And then someone else sees that and goes, why should I? And that's being deluded and misguided by the fault of others. That's one example. And I've seen 90% of the reaction is, why should I? And people give up serving or diminish their service. It's practically the first hurdle that we face in spiritual life. Being led by others in a completely negative way. And he says, others cannot harm you unless you harm yourself. This is harming ourselves. He said, have patience and introspect, which means to find faults in ourselves also. They have a fault. What's our fault? If we find that their fault is our fault, then we have to rectify it. We can't blame another person. Well, they're not doing it, so why should I? That's a completely illogical and nonsensical conclusion. It's an emotional conclusion. It's just an emotional reaction. It doesn't make sense. The floor has to be cleaned, but by cleaning the floor, you clean your own heart. Where is the question of why should I? Well, how do you end up there? You're only hurting yourself by not cleaning the floor. It becomes an ego issue, one of identity. That person is not cleaning the floor, so maybe cleaning the floor is not something that someone should do if they're at a certain status. Is that what it is? Oh, it's because I'm not initiated, but I have been in the movement 6 months. So maybe I should organize for someone who's a month in the movement to clean the floor. I went to a temple in Poland. This is in the very, 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 very early days of ISKCON Poland, in the early 90s. So Eastern Europe had just opened up. I don't know if some of you will remember that, but Eastern Europe and Russia and all, devotees couldn't officially go there. And temples started to spring up. And devotees started to get initiated en masse. But no one knew what was going on. And if you came into the yatra, there was a joke among swamis in Russia that everyone who met you, if you were an older devotee, if you were more than 6 months in the movement, they wanted to take initiation from you. They hadn't got a clue. So this joke among the swamis visiting Russia was, when you meet someone at the airport, they say, you say, my name is such and such swami, your name is... so I went to this temple and I was talking to one of the devotees, and all the devotees kept on saying, the Brahmins, the Brahmins, the Brahmins. I couldn't understand what they were talking about. And then there was one devotee, and there was something in the corner. I just went and picked it up, some bit of rubbish. And I said, where do I put this? And he said, oh, you don't touch that. You don't touch that. You're a Brahmin. I said, what? You know, I'm in a temple. It's Krishna's temple. There's dirt on the floor. You just pick it up. He says, no, but the Brahmins don't do cleaning. I said, what? You know, one part of my brain was going, hang on, I should live here. But it was so nonsensical. It's completely against our understanding, our philosophical understanding. We might be Brahmins, but we're not caste Brahmins. We're not hierarchical. In fact, Brahmanism doesn't mean very much to us at all. It really doesn't. I was asked the question recently, this discussion about women gurus and ISKCON and all that kind of stuff. And I was asked the question, so Janavima, who was the leader of the Gaudiya Vaishnav community, and it seems she initiated devotees, the devotees said to me. But did she really initiate, or did some man initiate and she just officiated? And did she actually give instruction, or did she send them to someone else to give instruction? I was thinking, oh my God. And then he said, did she give first initiation, but did she give second initiation? And all of this is so ignorant. These are questions from people who don't understand our tradition. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur brought in second initiation. There was no second initiation in our tradition until then. And he brought it in only to show the Brahmins that this is not special. Any Vaishnav is a Brahmin. He brought it in to put the Brahminical culture into a spiritual context. Janavima was fully a guru. That's what all the texts say. Her disciples wrote books. You have to understand Bengali to read them. But we have scholars who understand these things. Well, certainly in Oxford. And they're uncovering this stuff. And she was fully a guru. Fully the leader of the tradition. No question about it. In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there was one initiation. The holy name is the only thing. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, there is no lack of anything in the world except kirtan. Lack of kirtan is our only problem. Confirmed by the Lord. Krishna, Krishna. Let's read another thing. Well, in line of what we've just been saying about introspection, he said, look within, amend yourself, rather than pry into the frailties of others. And that's very much what he said previously. The issue is with us. If we're prying into the frailties of others, we're not doing our job. Our job is to amend ourselves, because we're the only person we're responsible for. So this is exceedingly good advice. All of this advice is learning how to practice the presence of God. Because otherwise we start to blame God, or we start to discredit God if we don't understand who we are and what our responsibility is. Then we blame God for our difficulties. How could a God allow the Holocaust to happen, or some such question? And in our tradition, these are actually nonsensical questions. We decided to come here. God didn't want us to come here. And everything that's happened since has been our choice. And every reaction has been a reaction to a choice we made. God isn't involved in this. We've created the world we live in. This is our philosophy. This is why we're not interested in karma. This is why we don't quote that it's my karma. For a devotee, it's Krishna. It's Krishna's mercy. We're not interested in karma. We don't even ascribe the cause to karma ultimately, because we only want Krishna. We want to practice the presence of God. We don't want to get caught up in this world. So these issues are not for us. So blaming God for our difficulty is really an abnegation of our responsibility. God created the material cosmos, yes, but we've come in and made the mess that we call the world we live in. That's what it is to understand ourselves. It's to understand our responsibility. It's our responsibility that we are where we are, and we have to fully accept that responsibility. And that's very difficult to face, that fact. And if we want to get out of it, that's what Krishna is waiting for. He's waiting for us just to say, help. What was Arjuna's only qualification? He asked for help. Otherwise, the Bhagavad Gita wouldn't have been spoken. But he asked Krishna, please help me. And this is what Bhaktisiddhanta is encouraging us to do. To understand ourselves, to amend ourselves, to get to the point of help, we have to understand what our responsibility is. And our responsibility is great. We are part of the creation of all the mess that this material world is. This isn't our first rodeo. We've been here before. The environmental mess that we're complaining about, we helped create it in a previous life. Our decisions have not been good. Prabhupada quoted that we didn't come here to be ladies and gentlemen. Becoming a devotee is learning how to become a lady and a gentleman. But that's not, people don't come to the material world to be ladies and gentlemen. You've come to be rascals and rogues. So we have to take that responsibility and turn it around. Turn our desire. Understand that Krishna is not the problem. Krishna is the solution. I suppose going on from that would be, in this world of Maya, averse to the Lord, full of trials and tribulations, only patience, humility, and respect for others are our friends for Hari Bhajan. In this world of Maya, averse to the Lord, full of trials and tribulations, only patience, humility, and respect for others are our friends for Hari Bhajan. It's very, so how do we, and this is Bhaktisiddhanta's theme, Hari Bhajan, Kirtan. He just keeps on coming back to this, the chanting of the holy name. This is his emphasis throughout his life. This is his point. So when it comes to the point in the Bagbazar temple in Calcutta, when the devotees start to argue, it becomes political in the temple about who gets which room based on seniority. And it came to Bhaktisiddhanta's attention. Then he said, sell the marble. Forget about it. Just preach. Just go out and preach. Just go out and do Harinam. Just do Kirtan. Forget about it. So this was a mistake. This is not the point. The point is to be this person. And this is the second time we've seen the word patience. It's an interesting word. It's not a word we hear a lot, to be patient. In the world we live in today, the world we live in is fueled by a specific drug. What is that drug, anyone? Any takers? The Enlightenment, in fact, the whole development of the modern intellectual process, the Industrial Revolution, is fueled by a specific drug. This drug came to this country, came to Europe, at precisely the time that people started to think in a different way, and it fueled their thinking to be a passionate form of thinking, very rajasic. The drug is coffee. Coffee came, in fact, the first coffee house in England was in Oxford. So the seat of the intellectuals. So the young intellectuals would gather in the coffee houses. That was the cool place to be. And coffee houses proliferated among the young. And they would sit down and drink this coffee and get a buzz. And they'd say, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? Forget tradition. Throw it out. We don't want tradition. We want new stuff. New stuff. Make it new. Ah. So modern society is dependent on coffee. First thing you get up in the morning, what do? You take a drug. Keep you ticking over. You're tired in the evening, your body is saying rest, you take a drug. Keep going. So it's a passionate world we live in. In this world of Maya, averse to the Lord, full of trials and tribulations, this doesn't lead to patience. It leads to short-term thinking. Gimme now. Satisfaction, now. Passion, being hyped up, leads to, I want that, I want it now. Gimme, gimme, gimme. So we don't talk about patience anymore. So this is about patience. This is spiritual life is about patience. We have to be patient. Why? Because we're asking Krishna to help us. We're asking Krishna to be part of our lives, to manifest himself in our lives. He wants to be part of our lives. Now, I want to see the Queen. So I went to Buckingham Palace the other day and I rattled the gates and said, let me see the Queen. Where is the Queen? I want to see the Queen. I don't believe her if I don't see her. What's my particular qualification to get in to see the Queen? Is the first question that someone asks. I don't even get to the door. I don't even get past the gate because I have no qualification whatsoever. What's our particular qualification to invite Krishna into our heart? Have we fluffed up the cushions? Have we got in some nice tea and a biscuit? Is it a nice place to be, our heart? How long does it take to redecorate? Patience. We have to think about it. We have to plan it out. We have to come up with a solution. Humility and respect are the other two things he mentions. Respect for others. Humility. These are big issues to contemplate. He said, and the world, he says, the world of Maya, is averse to the Lord. So he's talking about this. This quote is like from the early part of the last century. So approximately 100 years ago. So people then were averse to the Lord. In India, where we see as the godly, holy damn place, where people are averse to the Lord then. People were averse to the Lord at the time of Lord Chaitanya, where Jagai and Madai, you know, assaulted Lord Nityananda. People have always been averse to the Lord. This is the point. It's the nature of the world. There was no time of milk and honey. It's not the nature of this world. This world isn't a really great place. It says full of trials and tribulations. There's an acceptance in our philosophy, in Indian philosophy per se. It's the motivating factor behind Buddhism. There's an acceptance of the concept of suffering. You don't argue with it. You don't try and get away from it. It's just a fact of life. You accept suffering. You accept that this is a fact. Now, if we're in a one-life scenario, this is your philosophical worldview that there is only one life, you have to reject suffering. Philosophically, because otherwise you're really stuffed. If you're at my age and you haven't made it and you don't have the big house and the lordship and you haven't been a football player or a top model or something like that, then you've wasted your life, you know, and it's just downhill. And you're living in a semi-detached house in Luton and oh God, you know. Could be Swindon, sorry. Equally hellish. That's difficult. But if we understand that time is eternal and the nature of the world is eternal, then actually suffering is a normal part of life. The end of life is suffering. The beginning of life is suffering. And a lot of the middle is suffering. It's just the way it is. I asked one Swami one time, I was talking about astrology and all, and I said, how seriously should we take astrology? And he said, oh, very seriously. He said, give me your hand. And I gave him my hand, and he went, look, he says, there will be some suffering, some enjoyment, some suffering, some enjoyment, some suffering, some enjoyment, and then you'll die. Very serious. And that was about it. That's about every reading you're going to get is going to include a little bit of suffering, a little bit of enjoyment, and that's the ping pong game that we play in the world. It's full of trials and tribulations, just get on with it. And as Prabhupada said, happiness in a material context is relief from trials and tribulations. So for the periods when there isn't trial and tribulation, it's like, what's this? This is happiness. I'm ecstatic. Oh, you know. Trial, tribulation. That's life as we lead it. We don't know what's around the corner. You just accept that fact and get on with it. Patience, humility, and respect for others are our friends for Hari Bhajan. Why? Because this world really isn't what it's about. So anyway, there are some thoughts. They're all coming from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He's made such an important and positive contribution to our lives. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for his sacrifice, how he led his life, his mission, and him taking it so seriously. He did also quote that life is so short, what else are you going to do with it except use it for this purpose? And, you know, we think, I don't want to be seen as strange, or I don't want to be weird, or I'd like to be normal and do this and that. It doesn't matter. Life is so short anyway. You might as well just dedicate it to working hard for Krishna throughout your whole life. And that's his example. He just dedicated his life and everything he did for Krishna because he realized it's too short. And because of that, look at all of us. And look at all the other devotees who are listening by some technological means. And look at all the devotees who are celebrating this day all over the world. What an incredible achievement. That was a life well lived. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur ki. And thank you very much. Krishna. So I don't know if there, do you do questions and answers at these things?
Thank you very much for a very wonderful class, Prabhuji. In our Krishna consciousness, it's encouraged for us to leave our body in a holy dham, but it would seem like Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they left their bodies in Calcutta. I was wondering if you could shed some light, Prabhu.
It's very nice to leave our body in the holy dham, but if you dedicate your life to preaching in Minnesota, then it might be difficult. And what's the higher thing? The higher thing is to dedicate our life to Krishna, and we give Krishna our life, and wherever Krishna wants us to be, then that's where we are. So I'd love to go and live in the holy dham, but you know, Krishna always kicks me out. You know, I go there for a while, and after a while it becomes obvious that I have to do something else. My Prabhudatta Desh is here. My service is here. So this is where I serve. I go to the holy dham to recharge and get enthused. And when I go there, it's such a spiritual experience. I mean, everyone must have this experience. You go to the holy dham, you go to Vrindavan, and Krishna makes everything so obvious. It's instantaneous, practically. That's my experience, but I'm sure everyone has that experience. So you come back so full of Krishna that you can give to others. So it's not actually important for us to pass away in the holy dham. It would be very nice. But Krishna loves us anyway. He loves us no matter where we are. Krishna is not very religious. Of all the deities, Krishna is the one who doesn't care about religion more than anyone else, it seems. You know, Makanchor, he's a thief. And he's a liar. And he's a rascal. And he's quite loose with the girls. You know? Krishna's not about religion. He's about love. He loves us. And he loves us now, even though we're not perfect and we're not religious, even though we're trying to be religious and we're not making it. He loves us anyway. And he loves us more than we can imagine. He wants every opportunity for us to learn how to love him. And even if we don't take it, he still loves us. There's nothing we can do that will stop his love. So if we dedicate our life to preach in some far-flung part of the world, that far-flung part of the world becomes a holy dham. We can die in Krishna's grace anywhere, by Krishna's grace. Because Krishna can turn everything on its head. Anywhere can become Vrindavan. Anywhere where Krishna is Vrindavan. And Krishna is in our hearts. Vrindavan, Vrindavan. Thank you. Nice question.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. In the Bhagavatam classes, now we're going through prayers of Queen Kunti. I think there's some significance here as well. I was thinking, if there is, when we're doing our duty, we see that there is reciprocation from Krishna's side. But what if there is a period of life when we don't see that reciprocation? Like the acharyas, they've been pushing the movement. All the bad things will happen, but they will still keep going. So how can we tap into that inspiration to go through the period of life when we don't feel that much reciprocation from Krishna? Thank you.
Patience. It's really a word we don't understand. Prabhupada described that, he said, it's like you get on an airplane and you join the movement, you start chanting Hare Krishna. So when you join first, it's like ecstatic because you've never experienced anything like this. And every devotee is a little Prabhupada. And it's like everyone's pure and perfect and everything. Wow. And then after a while, you know, anyway, things change. And you go on. He said, but you continue doing your sadhana. It's like you get on an airplane and you're flying. And you're just flying in this metal tube. And you're just sitting there and there's nothing happening. And it's like, oh, did I make a mistake here? This is actually quite boring. Did you ever go on a 10-hour flight? That can be boring. You know? So, okay, so you keep on chanting, you keep on reading and all that kind of stuff. But oh, this is a bit boring now because I'm not getting something out of it. But the fact that we're not getting something out of it is the practice of Krishna consciousness. It's not about getting something out of it. It's about serving Krishna. We don't serve Krishna for stuff. We serve Krishna because that's what we do. And we're learning that fact. We're learning how that works. But the airplane lands, and when you land, you get out, and you're in a completely different place. It's like, oh, wow. It works. So they're all there. It's well known in the spiritual life that there are what you might call dry periods, periods a little desert-like. And that's where the word patience becomes relevant. Patience is one of the six symptoms of surrender. Again, as I say, we don't talk about it much. We just have to keep on going. But the fact is, if you keep on with your sadhana practice, with practicing the presence of Krishna in your life, and you maintain it, when a difficulty comes, you'll be in Krishna consciousness. When death comes, you'll be in Krishna consciousness. You'll see how Krishna is helping you. When a real tribulation comes in your life, all of a sudden Krishna comes, and so many devotees can testify to this, I can testify to this. You know, a really heavy thing happens in your life, and all of a sudden, in an instant, Krishna's there. And he's tangible. It's real. It's nearly surreal that it happens in such difficulty that you can feel such peace. But that's when the practice kicks in. And that's when you're getting off the plane. That's when you begin to realize what Krishna consciousness is and how profound this sadhana practice is. Chanting the holy name is so powerful. We have no idea until the test comes. So keep on with the chanting and practice the presence of God. Try and see little tribulations as Krishna. You know, some little thing happens in your life, you stub your toe, and you go, that's Krishna's kindness, thank you very much. Ah! And you can still go, ah! But just don't curse, just give it to Krishna. If you practice in little ways, when the big thing happens, You'll see Krishna. And Krishna, when you need Krishna, he's going to be there. And that becomes a fact in our lives. You can guarantee that.
Hare Krishna. Well, sorry.
He has the microphone.
I was first. Thank you very much. Beautiful class. I could hear you for hours and hours. Something regarding Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He is definitely so exalted person. But without Srila Prabhupada coming and tell us about or giving his credit, whatever he achieved to him, we would be lost. Even if he would come across on some of the works of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, will be lost. So that's one point why I'm getting into. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati met many dignitaries, many intellectuals, but the way he was speaking was so elevated that they couldn't grasp even this chapter. You read part of it. He just couldn't grab. He couldn't make any devotees out to them. So I'm just wondering, was he aware of this high intellectual language he was using? So that didn't suit to those people to change their heart. Or in matter of fact, he sent his disciples to try to do the same. They were not successful, but he himself was not very successful in preaching, especially I'm thinking about the English gentlemen, and he couldn't change their heart. So I'm just wondering, was he aware of that, or
Yeah. So the question is, was his vocabulary too intellectual for people to understand? Even if people didn't understand, I don't know how many people understood and didn't understand. Even if people didn't understand, they highly respected him because of it. He was given respect everywhere he went. So when he went to open temples in all the major cities, he was feted by the most important people in those places. And that's all recorded. So he was taken very seriously as a spiritual leader. And part of it was his intellectual prowess, without doubt. Now, he was using English vocabulary that for us is very difficult. I mean, I quoted some of it. It's difficult stuff. But he was, the vocabulary is appropriate. They are the proper words to use to express such a high idea. It's very interesting that in the Gaudiya Mat, they stuck to his vocabulary. And they didn't do as good a job as he did, in my observation. But Srila Prabhupada didn't. Srila Prabhupada used a completely different vocabulary. And Prabhupada's vocabulary is also very precise. If you study Prabhupada's English, his use of terms is very precise. It is exactly the right word. And it's words that we wouldn't use today. But it is, you know, I would reckon in 30 years' time, someone will have to kind of translate Prabhupada's works a little bit, because it's an English that isn't in vogue. But at the time that he was writing, it was. But his English is precise, so when you do translate it, you know what you're translating. So that's kind of a genius, that you communicate in such a way that you don't lose the meaning. Now, you're translating from Sanskrit and Bengali and Hindi and different languages, Brajbhash, that our scriptures are written in. That's never easy. You know, even the words International Society for Krishna Consciousness don't translate into some languages. That's how difficult translation is. So how do you translate Prabhupada's books? How do you translate Bhaktisiddhanta? How do you translate the ideas of Krishna consciousness? So the concept, Supreme Personality of Godhead, as a philosophical, theological concept, is genius. That formulation of words. Bhaktisiddhanta would say the transcendental autocrat. That formulation of words says it, but it's very clunky. You know, normally you just say God, and people kind of get it. But if you want to be specific, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there are many manifestations of Godhead. Who is the Supreme Person among those persons? It's emphasizing our philosophical approach. So I think, strangely enough, he did a very good job for future intellectuals, not for the common man. For the common man, it was Kirtan and Prasadam. So for most of us, it's Kirtan and Prasadam. But if you're an intellectual and you read Bhaktisiddhanta, actually, he's being very precise philosophically and theologically in his use of language, as is Prabhupada. So both of them were excellent communicators, strangely enough. But you think, if Prabhupada's an excellent communicator, why does he do these elaborate books with all the Devanagari stuff and everything? I mean, I read the preface of the Bhagavad Gita when I was 18, and I opened it up, and in the first paragraph, it said the words, Kurukshetra, Pandavas, Duryodhan, Arjuna, Yudhisthira. This is a different language. It was supposedly English. It was strung together with and this and that, and a few full stops, but, that was only the preface. I didn't read any of the rest of it. I just looked at the pictures. That were brilliant, by the way. Again, Prabhupada's genius of putting pictures in for thickos like me. And I read the Chaitanya Charitamrita in pictures when I was a young devotee. I just looked at the pictures and read the little paragraph underneath it. I learned so much about our philosophy. So they're really, these people are acting at a high intellectual level. And we have to respect that that's very much part of our tradition. We really have to invest in that. You know, and we say, oh, our people shouldn't go to university and everything. Well, just an hour away in Oxford, you have devotees who are experts in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. In actual fact, the academic study of Gaudiya Vaishnavism has transferred from another college and university in another country to this center in Oxford because their scholarship is so good. The fact they're devotees is beside the point. Their scholarship is so good. They're so good at what they do. So Bhrigupad Prabhu, he's studying the Hari Bhakti Vilas. No one has studied the Hari Bhakti Vilas. Have you ever seen it? As a palm leaf manuscript, it's that tall. He studied 100 editions to see if there are any variations so that he can come out with the definitive edition. So what do we find? What are the major festivals recommended in the Hari Bhakti Vilas for the Vaishnava community? What are the two major festivals, two primary ones, recommended in the Hari Bhakti Vilas? Gopranim? Out loud? Jamastami? Ratiyatra? Radastami? Nityananda Trayodasi? You got one right. No mention of Ratiyatra, no mention of Radastami, no mention of Gopranim, no mention of Nityananda Trayodasi, Janmastami. What's the other one, the other major festival? Shivratri. It's actually important to read these books. You mentioned of Shiva and we kind of go, psst. Shiva is actually important in our tradition. Gopeshwari. He guards Vrindavan. He comes to Vrindavan to participate in Krishna's pastimes. Shiva is no ordinary person, highly respected by all the Vaishnavas. Vaishnavanam ita shambhu. He's the greatest of all the Vaishnavas. His example, we're looking for his example, we're looking for his mercy so that we can become devotees of Krishna. So their knowledge, their expertise, their exploration, their use of language has a purpose. Even if we can't understand it, in humility we should understand we're thick. That's really what's going on. That's a very good way of stopping us. Well done. I think direct and to the point. Thank you very much. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur ki.